Today's episode is sponsored by John Paul the Great Catholic University at Escondido, California. St. John Paul II had a deep appreciation for the arts, and you may know that he was even an actor and a writer himself. He understood how influential storytelling and art can be on our culture, really having the power to move people's hearts towards God. Inspired by this call, John Paul the Great Catholic University is forming the next generation of creative professionals who will be bringing truth, beauty, and goodness to the entertainment industry. People who enroll can study film production, acting, animation, screenwriting, music design, and even video games. If you want to foster your God-given creative talents within a supportive and faithfully Catholic environment, we encourage you to explore JP Catholic's program and scholarships. JP Catholic is offering our listeners a full application fee waiver, which you'll find at jpcatholic.edu/herald. Pursue excellence in your creative craft without sacrificing your values. Visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. Perhaps you're not actually looking for a degree, but instead you want to sharpen your storytelling skills. JP Catholic also offers free online courses, such as a crash course in storytelling. Learn screenwriting from Christians who work in the industry. Whether you're interested in a full degree or free online classes, visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. That's jpcatholic.edu/herald, as in H-E-R-A-L-D. Welcome to Merely Catholic, with me, Gavin Ashenden.
As Christmas approaches, inquiring minds turn to books. Books we want to read for ourselves, and books we want to give other people to read. Who better to turn to for advice than a living author? Fiorella Nash is an author who writes under the pen name Fiorella de Maria. Her background is that of a working as a public affairs assistant for the Archdiocese of Westminster and then later on a researcher for the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child, but most importantly, a freelance author. A quick insertion of her name into Amazon shows an impressive list of her own work. And as one of the best informed women writers in the Catholic English-speaking world, an ideal person to talk to about books that need to be read, that we can either give or ask to receive. And she joins me now. Fiorella, this is very exciting for me. I don't get to talk to world-famous novelists very often. So I'm also in awe of novelists. I'm a scribbler of other people's ideas, and I'm just astonished at the imagination it takes to write a whole novel. But I guess some people are gifted at it. We're going to talk about your books and also books that people might give and receive over Christmas. So let me just ask, first of all, when did you discover you could write novels?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've always wanted to be a writer since I was about seven, though I would pay very good money never to see anything that I wrote before I was about 20. I wrote my first novel the summer I graduated. I had a nice long summer ahead of me and just really enjoyed the process. But I find it interesting that people are excited by novelists, because there are so many different kinds of writer. And I'm excited by journalists, because I don't know how you can cram one idea into 600 words. I need 80,000 words. I need lots of space to expand an idea. I think it's wonderful to be able to...
How interesting, because... So it's my xylophone. I see exactly the opposite way. The thing seems to me is, if you're really clever, which of course I'm not remotely, then you can take something of some complexity and reduce it to something of some direct simplicity and convey it, and do it in a way which somehow manages the simplicity and the complexity at the same time. But if you go over a certain number of words, you lose people's attention and you run the risk of a kind of myopic self-indulgence. Whereas I can't understand how you can get inside. I don't want to get inside other people's heads. I think it's a bit rude, but that's what the novelist has to do, isn't it?
I suppose so. I never thought of it that way, but I suppose that's exactly what one does. And I suppose if you have the sort of imagination where you're constantly living in an alternative world, it just becomes quite natural. I've always thought it's the profession for people who never really grew out of the dressing up box. It's a sort of grown-up version of that in a way. And am I inside other people's heads? I suppose to some extent, but there's no such thing as an entirely fictional character. They're always based on somebody, though I'm not supposed to admit that.
No, you're supposed to write. We have these exciting disclaimers. It's all completely fictional in case one discovers that one's in there. Well, that's very good. You're mainly an adult author, but haven't you written some children's books recently, presumably because you've started having children?
Well, yes, I have. Well, I have children of that age to be reading YA literature. So I suppose it was always going to happen. My adult literature is definitely not for children. It's looks at very adult themes of, you know, slave trade, the war, the Holocaust, things like that. But more recently, I was asked by Ignatius Press to write books about Catholic heroes for a new series. Reading age, I'd say about 8 to 14, depending on the precocity of the child, I suppose. And my most recent one was a book about Willie Doyle, whose Course for Canonizations come up some time ago. I love Willie Doyle.
Tell us about, not everyone will know who Willie Doyle is. Would you tell us a bit about him?
Yes, he was a chaplain, a Jesuit during the First World War. He was killed trying to rescue somebody in no man's land. He's an incredibly saintly man. And the more I've learnt about him, the more important I think he is as a saint for the world. But it's time Ireland had some new saints. And I think the simplicity of his and the just the complete straightforwardness of his spirituality, I think I found very attractive. So that was a challenge writing about the trenches for children. Well,
just one second. What does straightforward spirituality mean?
I mean, just very practical on a day-to-day basis. He'll, you know, I suppose because he was so influenced by the spiritual exercises and the idea of, you know, finding God in small things, he'll say things like, "Well, every saint will say at the end of the day, failed again, better luck tomorrow." he takes that very much that approach. I quite often find myself saying that, okay, failed again, better luck tomorrow. And you know, the minutiae, that your relationships with other people, the way you live your life. I mean, obviously, he was called to do something really extraordinary, being sent to the Western Front just as the Somme was starting. But he knew that most people don't live like that. He was very much a champion of the working classes. He felt that Ireland, the Irish Church, had lost the working classes. He felt that spiritual exercises and retreats were regarded as a bit of a middle-class hobby, and maybe religion was becoming a bit of a middle-class hobby. So he ran retreats for working men with the Guinness factory, and he'd go out to the dockyards to meet people. And that was, in fact, why he enlisted to be a chaplain, because he felt, well, there were thousands of working-class Irishmen out there, and he wanted to be with them. So I found that a really beautiful experience writing about him. I've also written something a bit more light-hearted for children about a skating family, because all my children are ice skaters, and they complain that nobody knows what ice skating's about. So that's just a very much a tongue-in-cheek story about a large homeschooling Catholic family who happened to live next to an ice rink, and I wrote that for sheer pleasure. And
very how far away from your ice rink do you live?
5-minute drive. Not quite on the doorstep, but it's pretty close to being on the doorstep. And I do feel like I live there most of the time.
Right.
I do spend a lot of time there.
Your thing of darkness was about Dracula. And I mean, that's quite a shady place to go, isn't it?
Well, yes, I'd never written horror before. It's all K.V. Turley's fault. It was his idea. I co-authored it with K.V. Turley. It was very much his story, the idea of Bela Lugosi, the actor who was made famous by the Dracula film. And it's an alternative history, if you like, imagining Bela Lugosi getting drawn into the occult, drawn into this very dark world within the Hollywood horror industry, and there's this young journalist who's trying to make sense of it all, and it's a classic horror story, but very much with a twist. And I think Catholics are very good at writing horror myself, because we understand about the powers of darkness and need to fight them.
We do. I mean, they're one wants to keep away from them as much as possible. Our good friend Simon Caldwell has a novel, The Beast of Bethulia Park, which the sequel to which Mabel's Gold is coming out next year. You look quite, if I may say so. I mean, you don't. How can I say this politely? Both you and Simon have looks of frank stability and simplicity. It's very difficult to think of you both delving the occult as you quite both clearly have done. Have you read Simon's Beast of Bethulia Park?
I have. I was at his book launch, in fact, and I. Well, it's interesting you say that about sort of stability and all of the rest, because I gather exorcists have to be pretty stable individuals. So
absolutely.
My thought is that people who do venture into these fields probably have to have a healthy scepticism as much as anything else. And certainly the way...
Now scepticism about not about evil, but presumably scepticism about manifestation of evil on the grounds that one of the obvious alternatives you're looking for is some kind of psychological or psychiatric disturbance. Is that what you're mean by scepticism?
Yes, not scepticism of the existence of evil, obviously, but yes, the manifestation of it. And we always start by looking at, is there mental illness here? And in fact, in this thing of darkness, the journalist Evie Kilhooley is... She has her demons. She has a drink problem. She's a widow. She's bereaved. It's quite possible she may be mentally ill. It's uncertain all the way through the book whether she really is having these bizarre experiences or whether it's all in her mind.
So now when you say has, the phrase, what I love about the way in which people talk is that they in popular language, people talk as though evil is real. I love the phrase, I don't know what got into me. I think that's absolutely quite... And also the phrase, she has her demons. Now, as a novelist, when you use the phrase, she has her demons, are you deliberately using it ambiguously in both senses?
Absolutely. There are... Well, she has her own struggles, which is the way people tend to mean it these days. In that, you know, her husband died in the Korean War. It's the 1950s. You know, she was a GI bride, came over to the States, lots of excitement. Then her husband goes off and disappears into the hell of the Korean prison camps. And she struggles to move beyond this. She struggles with drink. She struggles with money. There's all sorts of things that are very wrong in her life. And then she gets forced to do this series of interviews with Bela Lugosi. She doesn't even like films. She doesn't like movie stars. She doesn't like horror. She thinks it's stupid. She is very much the skeptic. And she gets stuck with this project she doesn't want. Any jobbing journalist will appreciate. And he seems to be capable of touching her buttons. He seems to know a lot about her. She becomes progressively more and more frightened and confused by him. As the book goes on, things start to happen. She starts having very disturbing nightmares, for example, about her husband's death, which she doesn't know anything about. So there's obviously some sort of supernatural influence at work in her life as well. So yes, it comes from both ends. And of course, the other evils we have to deal with, well, where are they coming from? It's not so clear cut, is it?
One of the things that really interests me about this is the way in which you talk with such energy about this, but yet you said your qualification for doing this was a degree of psychological and spiritual stability. Is your interest in this then because you're captivated by the intellectual and the theological problems of evil, which you're in a position to translate into the role of the imagination? And if it's not, in other words, which side of the dotted line you drew earlier on are you?
Well, initially, I would say I just thought the whole horror genre was a load of rubbish. I've never watched scary films. I don't get why people even find them frightening. Whenever I'm watching a horror film or reading one, I always think, look, just call a priest, do an exorcism, everything will be fine. Look, why are you wasting your time with things that go bump in the night? It was very much Kevin Turley had this idea, and he really encouraged the idea of exploring, I suppose, the presence of evil. Maybe, you mentioned the way people use expressions like, she had her demons, I don't know what got into me. But society knows that evil exists and yet denies it. You know, most people don't believe in the existence of the devil and tend to do what C.S. Lewis used to talk about, you know, imagining a man in red tights, see the devil as a kind of comical figure. And yet evil is real. And by writing about it, one hopefully should alert people to the reality of evil.
And in a way, that's partly what the ambition to be a saint will inevitably get us into, because we will find ourselves confronting our own demons, whether the demons are psychological imbalances or whether, as we press forward closer to Christ, we find ourselves annoying the other side, which seems to me to be an inevitable concomitant of being a Christian. So it does require some people to interpret this. It's one thing to do it from the pulpit or as a homily, but it's much more effective, isn't it, to do it by telling stories?
Well, absolutely. And the fact is, this thing of darkness, yes, it is about the occult. It is about exactly what the title suggests, but it is about the battle between good and evil. And I'm trying not to give away too much of the story. That's why I'm being a little bit vague. But the fact is that you discover things about what happened to Evie's husband that start to make sense sort of what is happening to her, that she is in fact being protected. She wears a miraculous medal that he gave her, and Bela Lugosi doesn't like it, or the person she thinks is Bela Lugosi, and won't come close to her when she's wearing it and things like that. So it's not primarily about evil in the end. It's about good triumphing over evil.
Some of the commentators that we're reading nowadays suggest that our neighbours are falling into a form of neo-paganism, and that they, you know, they have... They're deeply superstitious. They're frightened of evil. It's almost as if the last 1500 years haven't happened, and we're going back to some extent. It seems to me that somebody writing like you, it's a great act of evangelism, because the way in which we converted people from paganism was to tell them that our God is stronger than their God, and our God can set them free from the things that they're frightened of and that draw them into darkness. In that sense, because that's perfectly true, a novelist then is a kind of evangelist for this new task of evangelizing our neighbors, caught as they are in fear and anxiety and superstition.
Oh, absolutely. That's a big part of my work. In fact, I have a workshop, and it's called How to Write a Book and Save the World.
Right.
And I look at this whole idea because I think we are very influenced by stories. Jesus was a storyteller. Most people, if they've had any kind of contact with Christianity whatsoever, and you ask them to tell them a story, or tell you a story about Christianity, what are they likely to say? Mary and Joseph, and they went to Bethlehem, and they had the baby, and the shepherds, and the wise men, and whatever, because they will have been in a nativity play. They will know that story. They may not know very much about Jesus, but they will know about the birth of Jesus because they will have been told the story, and better, they will have acted out the story. It tends to be stories that people remember. They won't remember, if you say, tell me the Ten Commandments, forget it. I gather most vicars don't know the Ten Commandments now when they get put on the spot. Let's face it, it's difficult to recall. But stories do stick in the mind, and stories are flight simulators for the mind. They're ways in which people can explore ideas and perhaps relax enough to consider ideas. You talked about being inside other people's minds when we were chatting at the beginning. Being a novelist, you're sort of inside other people's heads. Well, that's not such a bad thing, in that it can allow people to see things from a different perspective. And some of our great storytellers, Dickens, brilliant storyteller, and he changed the society in which he was living.
Stories.
Yeah,
yes,
I've just
suddenly seen the possibility of the parable as a novella. You know, Jesus is quite clearly more of a novelist than he is a journalist, and yeah, yes. You know, each parable is a kind of compressed novella, which it doesn't get you into the mind. It at least gets you into a mindset. And in order to change how we look at the world, which I guess is, again, partly what a novelist is trying to do. Let's go back to Dickens and talk about the way in which he changed society by telling stories. Because inevitably, if we're going to be talking about Christmas and the opportunity of giving people books, although the great gift of YouTube is that you will have people listening to this at every time, discovering us at different seasons of the year. But in what way do you think Dickens managed to change his society by just writing stories?
Well, I think he created compelling characters that people could relate to. And Christmas Carol, I think, is almost the perfect example of that. Just 9 years before the publication of Christmas Carol, you had the Poor Law Amendment Act, which made it very, very difficult for poor people to get help. You couldn't get money anymore. You had to go to the workhouse. The workhouses were notoriously brutal institutions. Families separated, men and women separated. And it was, of course, based on that Malthusian idea that we shouldn't look after the poor. And so in A Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is famously asked if he will give alms at Christmas, and he says the words, "If the poor are going to die, they better go and do it and decrease the surplus population," he was pretty much slapping society across the face with its own prejudices. That is Malthus. He's quoting Malthus very, very directly. And, of course, you then have Tiny Tim. And what really he's saying to the reader is, by the surplus population, did you mean Tiny Tim? That dear, darling cherub of a boy, you want Tiny Tim to die, do you? How horrible of you. This despicable thing to do. What a lovely little boy. What a lovely family. And you want them to die because you want the surplus population to disappear. So he's giving a human face to a statistic, a social problem. And it did make a difference. Almsgiving did go up. Philanthropy did go up after the publication of that book. He did live to see changes in the workhouse system, education, for example, being introduced for children. So I think he was a great example of how you can be a good storyteller and have a message. Sometimes people are so caught up in the message that the story suffers. There are a lot of aspiring writers out there trying to write Catholic propaganda and the stories aren't good. But what he shows is you can write a really good story and you can make change.
I'm very struck by the idea that the Malthusian ideas are back. Malthus is certainly back. And there are attempts to cull the population with abortion, the children that have never been, the Shakespeares that never saw the light of day, trying to cull the population by getting rid of Tiny Tim when he's a pensioner and in need of a little bit more support instead of the other. And then, of course, the whole disastrous culling of fertility with our teenagers by allowing them to have sex change operations inflicted on them. Are you aware of ways in which Catholic novelists are trying to get inside people's heads to humanize the statistics that are being used by the new Malthusians?
Yes, I think if you look at some novelists who are writing at the moment, someone like Corinna Turner, for example, with her, she writes for young adults. Her books, I Am Margaret, which is a futuristic look at a world in which people who fail the fitness test are recycled, literally, are used as donor parts and things like that. A number of writers I'm noticing are using the futuristic genre to explore where we might go as a society. It allows a certain freedom. And certainly in Corinna's books, you see, you know, a child with a disability who fails the test and the way the rest of them try to save her. In my own books, I look at disability. I do look at crisis pregnancy, though I think one has to be a little bit careful about being too obvious when talking about that subject. I do try to explore, well, particularly subjects, I think, for example, mental illness is still very stigmatized in our society. I'm aware that the first victims of the Nazis were schizophrenics way back in the 30s. But there's still a certain horror, particularly about people who suffer from psychotic illness. We were talking about mental illness earlier. I think it's still an issue. The story always has to come first, but you can explore these things. Crime fiction is a very good way of talking about human life, because in the end, it always surrounds a murder. And why are we worried about murder? Because actually, we know that it's a really bad idea to kill somebody. And in my murder mysteries, the seriousness of what the person has done very much comes to the fore. You see people being executed. It's not just the solving of the mystery. It's also trying to look at what happens to people when there is death in the midst of a society, because that is the situation we have. We have death right at the heart of our society now.
I'm very interested in the way in which some of our more famous authors have been the subject of sort of revisionist takedowns. Dickens, for example, I mean, the way in which you describe Dickens as changing the whole of the face of society through his imaginative storytelling is very impressive. But of course, people have begun to look at his private life and say, we can't allow ourselves to be too impressed by him because, well, the way he treated his wife, his private peccadilloes, they're all too problematic to be able to allow us to accept moral tales from a man as morally flawed. It strikes me that novelists should be morally flawed, or else then they're not going to be able to. I'm not asking you to engage in confession online, but if there isn't at least a potential for moral flaw in a novelist, how on earth will they know how to get inside the heads of people who are morally flawed?
Well, I think in the end, the extent to which a writer is morally flawed, I mean, every writer has his or her flaws. I'm going to close that particular door before you ask. But I think that in some ways, we've turned into a kind of form of Puritanism. We've created a form of Puritanism where, as far as I'm concerned, that the private life of the novelist is completely irrelevant, or should be irrelevant, to your understanding of the writing. It's impossible not to infer certain things when you know a lot about a writer's background, but it strikes me as none of anybody's business. Do the stories make sense?
I'm sure you're right. It is a form of new Puritanism, partly, I think, because people have lost, but by losing Catholicism, they've lost the wonderfully complex and helpful moral compass that Catholicism brings. I'm aware, for example, in the world of music, some of the most wonderful singers and artists I know don't have an inner moral life that is symmetrical to the beauty of the art they produce. And you think, how is it possible that somebody whom you happen to know is not behaving in the best moral way can produce such purity, such goodness, such loveliness? So presumably, I mean, there's no obvious link between the performance of beauty and the artists themselves.
No, and I think we have to guard against that tendency a little bit, even within the Catholic community. I mean, I've had people very seriously say to me that I shouldn't watch The Passion of the Christ because Mel Gibson's not a very nice man, you know. He's done things, you know, cheated on his wife.
Do they really say that?
I've had someone literally deliberately argue that you know, the film itself should not be taken seriously morally because of the moral dubiousness of the director. Whereas I just find it ludicrous as an idea. This seems to me quite an ancient idea and quite a recent idea at the same time. It feels like going back to Cromwell's Republic almost.
Yes, I agree. Well, but and yet there is an argument in there. I mean, for example. I probably know more about music than I do about literature in some ways, but I won't. The only person I won't listen to, I can't listen to, well, apart from Stockhausen, because he's got no tunes, but but I can't listen to Wagner, and I've never ever been able to listen to him. And I know Wagner produces the most amazing music, and I know all the things one should say about the way in which he deals with the operas and his mastery of orchestration, and but I can't listen to it. It makes me feel ill. And I think it's because he's a Nietzschean. I think that the ideas that consumed Wagner somehow come out in the music. If so much of the conflict that we experience as human beings is love and the perversion of power, I hear the perversion of power all the time. But I don't think that's... I'd want to say that Wagner's the exception, and that in almost every other aspect of art, it doesn't carry over like that. There isn't, one's being too simplistic if one says there has to be a degree of aesthetic or moral purity in the artist in order for them to, I hate to use the word channel, but it's probably the best word, to channel the art that they're doing. So one has to hold these two ideas in tension, doesn't one? The Puritanism versus the fact there is an occasional Wagner.
Yes, I think so. And of course, what you're probably experiencing with Wagner is that in that case, his ideas creep into the music and you find it jarring listening to the music. And that certainly can be the case reading literature. There are some authors I don't like because they're rather harsh, rather misanthropic views do come into their stories, and I can't really relate to them. I think that always happens.
So we're talking about the difference in moral failure on the one hand, which everybody has, and no one should, including Mel Gibson, should be penalised for, and moral vision, which can be perverse. In other words, if the artist has a perverse moral vision, we're going to pick that up, but not necessarily pick up human failure.
Yes, I think that's a good distinction to make. And you mentioned that writers sort of almost have to be morally flawed in order to be able to explore perhaps the complexity of the human experience. Yes. And I'm not sure, well, I suppose we're all morally flawed, so in some ways anyone could be a writer, I guess, in that respect. But I certainly do think that for writers to be successful, they have to have a level of life experience. They don't necessarily have had to have done everything, but certainly have had to have some exposure to, well, suffering and struggle of some kind, because conflict is at the heart of writing. And I do try to discourage aspiring writers who have had very sheltered lives, who are leading exemplary lives, who have had, you know, very happy family backgrounds, maybe have been homeschooled have had, you know, a very good wholesome start to life, the like of which I would want to provide for my children, but then who try and write about very complex, very distressing subjects, you know, self-harm and mental breakdown and, you know, rape and things like that. And I think I'm not really sure you're qualified to delve quite that deeply into darkness when you've never been there. I don't think people should go out of their way to have bad experiences so they can be better writers, but there's also a level of humility may be necessary when engaging in writing, of saying, well, what are my emotional limits? What are my moral limits?
What are the books that you suggest people might want to discover in terms of reading for Christmas or giving for Christmas? And they might have Christmas themes, or Christmas is essentially all about the conflict between good and evil as the light comes into the dark world at the darkest time of the year in order to help us make our way from where we are to the uplands of heaven. You can't get a more moral moment than Christmas. What are the books that you want to give people to read or suggest they read themselves?
Well, for young children, Madeleine Carroll has some beautiful books, beautifully illustrated books about the Christmas story, which I think provide a lovely, I was going to say magical, but it's not the word I meant, very...
Enchanted. Enchanted is a new Dreyer-ish word for us to try and build a bridge from the supernatural to the other side without falling into magic.
Yes, it's a very tender, very human take on the Christmas story. May I suggest a few of my books? Is that allowed?
Please do. No. That must be the quid pro quo for taking up your time this morning. Please go ahead.
Well, my skating story I mentioned earlier, it's called My Family and Other Skaters. It's a nod to Gerald Durrell. And in fact, it ends at Christmas time. So you have the whole family experience of Christmas, and they meet a homeless man and various other things happen to them as they're getting ready for Christmas. And it's, I'd say that's probably for about 8 to 12 readership. And one of my mystery stories, in fact, is set just after Christmas, because there's something very cosy about a murder in the snow.
Of course there is.
I don't know what it is, but people like, I don't know why, but people like murder mysteries because they're safe. And there's a form of escapism. All my murder mysteries happen in a little English village, you see, and it's what most people imagine that the 1940s was like. See no evil.
Agatha Christie said that the whole of human existence takes place in an English village, and presumably there's some kind of contrasted disjunction between a dead body and the purity of the snow. Is that partly what it is?
Probably. I think also that, well, winter weather tends to isolate people. You get trapped in that country house, and See No Evil, they're all there for a party and they all get stuck there. And there's someone dead in a ravine, and did he fall or was he pushed? I think the reason why people like English village murder mysteries is because you do get a lot of characters in villages. Agatha Christie was absolutely right. But there's also a certain moral certainty about a murder mystery. Something terrible happens, which we know is terrible. We know deep down the taking of human life is an awful thing to happen. And then the detective steps in as this moral authority figure who then puzzles things out, works out the truth, and restores the moral order.
And you have personal accountability in a village that you don't have in a city. I mean, one of the dreadful things about a city is that it's the anonymity and the impersonality, but the village presumably is a community where you have accountability and personality. And so moral order is consequently worse when you lose it and more cheered when you recover it, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose everyone knows everyone. And also people's lives are much more intertwined. So it's when things go wrong, it has the capacity to damage a lot more people. A lot more people are likely to be implicated in a moral disaster as well. I suppose in cities you still have communities, though, don't you? You have groups of people, whether they're around a parish or a place of work, but it's not quite the same.
Well, ideally you do. If you're well balanced and lucky, you might find a community. But of course, a lot of people in the city can't find any community, and that's probably, or at least, you know, not if it doesn't involve drug dealing or other groups that are badly behaved. So, yes, that's true. So, your novels. So, any more of your own novels you want to promote?
Well, it depends really what you're interested in. I wrote a book about the slave trade called Poor Banished Children. If you want to learn more about what happened to the Mediterranean slave trade, it's an area of that terrible trade that's not really talked about very much. My own people were taken into slavery, so it's slightly personal.
Are you Maltese? Who are your own people? Yes, that's what.
Yes, I'm Maltese background, and I'm from slave ancestry. And that in itself, Gavin, is a sign of the world we live in. I mentioned that I do a workshop where I talk about how to change the world writing a book. It's because we all live in a narrative. So if you want to change society's narrative, you create another narrative. And we all live in a narrative of our own that's connected up with our family background and everything. Now, my mother's family were aristocrats and knights and noblemen who fought the Turks and things like that. And we talked a lot about that when I was growing up. That felt, you got a lot of kudos from saying you were from a sort of aristocratic background of, you know, people who fought to save Christendom. My father's family were from slave ancestry. And do you know something? We didn't talk about that when I was a child. I only found out about it later because it was really embarrassing. You didn't want to admit that your people had been snatched from their coastal villages and taken in chains to the market and things like that. Whereas now, because victimhood is so popular, it's really cool to say you're from slave ancestry.
Any chance of you getting reparations?
From Morocco, I think it's unlikely, unfortunately. Maybe I should be pushing that one. Yes, I've also written about, I've written other mystery stories. Most Dangerous Innocence is my most popular novel after my crime fiction. A whole lot of books for younger readers as well. Just trying to get the Catholic heroes who've been forgotten. People like Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, you know, made famous by The Scarlet and the Black.
Yes,
Maximilian Kolbe, of course, is famous. I've just completed a book about Al Schwartz, the American priest who went out to Korea. So there's something for everyone.
I just had the experience of an old friend of mine who's, I mean, one of the most intelligent and best read people you could imagine, and who's paid millions of pounds for the very clever he did. And he said, I was in church the other day, and the vicar decided to talk about someone called Max Kolbe or something. He was an extraordinary story, quite extraordinary. And I thought, I cannot believe that you, my dear sophisticated friend, have never ever heard of St. Maximilian Kolbe. I mean, he just never had. You know, all the figures in the Second World War who are often adduced for as examples of the sacrifice of incarnational love. Anyway, so it's a good thing to bring Catholic heroes whom the hoi polloi have lost or never heard of to the fore, I think.
Yes, and I think it's important that they are remembered. And there's a lot of negativity two of those characters I mentioned, Hugh O'Flaherty and Willie Doyle, both from Ireland, and we know the difficulties Ireland is having at the moment. Remembering the heroic witness of people like Hugh O'Flaherty, who saved thousands of lives in Rome during the war, the church is often wrongly accused of not having done anything to save anyone. Well, actually, an awful lot of people died including a lot of Hugh O'Flaherty's friends, trying to save people. And I think their stories have to be remembered. And I'm amazed that Maximilian Kolbe wouldn't be known by everybody, because...
Me too. No, yeah, I couldn't believe it. I wanted to tell him without sounding religiously and superior and pretentious. How is it a man like you cannot know this? How can I have been friends with you for 5 years and never brought it up? My fault, obviously. But anyway, never mind. That was the case. So
he assumed he knew. I should think because he's such a famous.
But then again,
you know, when I wrote about Maximilian Kolbe, I learned so much about his life that I didn't know. Of course, we all know about his famous sacrifice. It's the defining moment, and yet I didn't realize that he'd gone to Japan and evangelized in Japan, and in fact that his monastery on the outskirts of Nagasaki became a very important focal point after the dropping of the bomb, because it was saved because of its position, and the friars ran down into the streets after the bomb had been dropped to look after people, and they ended up looking after 1,000 orphans.
Goodness.
After Nagasaki, you know, they were seeing children running around and realised the parents were gone and said, oh, we better take them back with us. And in the end, they were looking after 1,000 children. So long after he died, his work was helping people, and his friend, Brother Zeno, became a national hero in Japan. So there was a lot about Maximilian Kolbe's life I didn't know.
Yes.
There was a real joy to discover.
Well, there's always more for us all to discover, which is partly the purpose of books. So any we're getting near the end of people's attention span, I imagine, although I'm enjoying this enormously. Any last minute books that you'd like to suggest that people might want to either buy for themselves or give away at Christmas?
Well, Joseph Pierce has a book about the top novels of the 20th century. What was it, the title?
Yes, he does. He's written an article, which in fact I happen to have with me here. But he does have he's turned it into a book, isn't he?
He's written a book. I can't find the title. Hang on, do you want to just pause while I find the title? If you're looking for a book that just is an introduction, if you like. I'm just going to have to look it up, sorry. There is a book. There is a book that's just come out. It's literally being launched tomorrow in Dublin, which will be the 21st of November for anyone watching this later, called The Rock From Which You Were Hewn. And it's a collection of stories about Irish heroes, some of them martyrs, some of them 20th century, some of them much older. And it's a very good introduction to, well, the lives of saintly men and women, some of whom probably will never have their causes opened, some whose causes have recently been opened.
Who's it by?
It's a collection. It's edited by Father John Hogan, and it's published by Cenacle Press in Ireland, and for the rest of the world, it's Ignatius Press. And a book you might want to consider by Joseph Pierce is Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know.
Well, that's probably a very good book to put in the stocking of your Catholic family or friends. Fiorella, thank you so much for spending this time. It's been wonderful catching up and talking, and all very good wishes for a happy Advent and Christmas when it comes. It's been lovely to have a discussion.
Thank you. Lovely to chat again.